It's All Things Considered from North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Two familiar voices are here to review the week in state politics. Rob Schofield from the Progressive NC Policy Watch and Becky Gray from the conservative John Locke Foundation. Hey there.
Hey there.
Hi, guys.
More drama at the State Board of Elections. On Monday, the chair of the five-member board, Bob Cordle, made a sexual joke at the start of a training for several hundred election officials from across the state. By sunset on Tuesday, he had resigned. This side spectacle played out while the board also this week considered new voting machines, and specifically whether all machines in use next year will have human-readable paper records as opposed to barcodes. No decision on that front yet. Are you both in agreement that A, the Cordle joke was inappropriate and creepy and he needed to go, and B, paper records are good for elections and for democracy?
Yes.
Me too.
Yeah,
I mean, he clearly had to.
You can elaborate if you want.
He clearly had to go. I mean, this is, it's 2019. There's no place for this stuff anymore. I mean, to Cooper's credit, he's done this on a couple of occasions now where people who've gone over the line when it comes to sexually inappropriate conduct or inappropriate comments are just out of here. That's just the way it's got to be. I think it actually stands in sort of stark contrast to another topic we've been discussing here for a long time, which was a state lawmaker, now former state lawmaker, who was actually accused of sexual, really violent behavior, domestic violence behavior, not sexual behavior, and was not asked to leave for months and months. So I'm delighted that this happened, and it was certainly essential.
Just to be clear, you're delighted with the outcome. You're not delighted that he made the joke.
Of course. I'm delighted that Governor Cooper made it clear to him that he had to go.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. You know, the joke was inappropriate. You know, the context, the group, I mean, all of it. And so you really have to question somebody's judgment that serving as the chair of the State Board of Elections, who would think that was a good idea. You know, I think that reflects on what other choices and judgments are they going to use. So I think, for number one, the joke was offensive. It was inappropriate. And then also, I think I think he lost all of his credibility with that. So that's good. I hope that the governor will choose someone to replace him. You know, what we saw earlier this week was a standoff in one of the votes because there's only four people on the State of Board of Elections now. That position needs to be filled because there's decisions mm-hmm. in front of them. So I hope the governor will make a choice. This is the third elections official, I think, that he has appointed. That has resigned. So I hope the governor will make a thoughtful choice, make a good choice. All of this is really in the weeds. I mean, I think we all agree the paper ballots are better, but it really comes to the question of getting our election system shored up, get it all well managed, working well, because I think that speaks to the integrity of elections and the confidence that people have in the election. And so we need to move forward with this and get all this stuff straightened out.
Yeah, I would just add that I think the paper ballot record is essential in this era of hacking of elections, of interference from foreign governments in our elections. We've got to have a backup. And the idea that you just push a computer button and you never see again whether it actually registered what you thought it registered is something that we need to address.
And I think this speaks to the important decisions that rest with the State Board of Elections and why it matters who is appointed to that board. These are decisions that don't have anything to do with political parties on one side or the other.
They shouldn't, exactly.
They were divided this week along some Republicans and some Democrats on different sides of the issue.
But it matters. You know, that it's another example of why it matters who is appointed to these boards and commissions, whether it's the Board of Governors, whether it's this. You know, these things are really important and we need to pay attention to it. We need to have the confidence that whoever is making those appointments is taking things into consideration.
Campaign fundraising reports from the first half of 2019 were made available this week. Some of the takeaways: Governor Roy Cooper raised three times as much money as Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest, who is vying for the Republican nomination and then to try to unseat Cooper. Democratic Attorney General Josh Stein has more than 10 times the cash on hand than his, for now, only Republican challenger. Republican Treasurer Dale Falwell has significantly less than one of his Democratic challengers. Then on the judicial front, Republican Paul Newby outraised the Chief Justice Sherry Beasley, a Democrat. Remember that Newby, the senior member of that bench, felt that he was passed over for the court's top spot and is challenging her next year. That as some of the backdrop context. Please share one number that stood out to you and why.
Mark Meadows, who is increasingly a national figure, 89% of his money came from out of state. This is a man who was elected to a small, you know, district in western North Carolina, and yet for some reason, almost all of his money comes from out of state contributors.
I don't have a number, but just a couple of thoughts with the trends that we're seeing. First of all, the fact that Cooper, Josh Stein have raised so much money, you know, that's the power of incumbency. Now, Del Falwell hasn't, but we also know Del Falwell has been embroiled in this controversy with the state health plan. So, I mean, it always speaks to the I think there's a power of incumbency with raising money, and I think that's a trend that you see across things. Some of the other reports we've seen, Jeff, you know, as you mentioned in the introduction, this is the year-end quarter. This is when the fundraising reports come in. So it's always interesting to look at those, I think. And so just some other trends that we're seeing. I mean, these races are going to be expensive. We're seeing a tremendous amount of race of money coming into that 9th congressional race in Charlotte as that heats up for the September 10th election, for that special election, seeing a tremendous amount of money coming in that. Also, there was a report this week just on the Raleigh fundraising, that there are, I think, record numbers that are coming into the Raleigh races. So politics is expensive, and it seems like it's getting more expensive.
Picking on you for a second, Rob, you said, I believe it was 87% of Meadows. 89%. This, of course, is the congressman from the western part of the state, Republican, leads the Freedom Caucus, hard right line, hard line group of
big Trump supporter.
Member, right. Did you juxtapose that to any of the other House members? That 80, I mean, that strikes me as very high. But
I haven't yet. I just saw that number. It was in a National Citizen Times report. But I think it is worth noting that, as Becky alluded to, there is big money pouring in, and it's not all just going to go to the candidates. It's going to go to these affiliated committees and to the parties, and we're literally could be looking at tens of millions of dollars spent on this 9th district election, maybe not quite that much, but certainly millions of dollars, and 2020 bodes even worse in terms of big, dark money, unaccountable money. It again, I think, illustrates a huge problem that we have in campaign finance laws in the United States, and the fact that we our elections are up for sale, and the vast majority of the big money is coming from a handful of very wealthy donors on either side of the political spectrum, and that's just a lousy way to run a democracy.
Well, and another example of that this week, we saw the formation of the North Carolina Democrat Leadership Committee, which is a new fundraising arm of the Democratic Party. So, you know, we are seeing that. I think that it speaks to also how important we are as a state now in these national races, these congressional races in North Carolina. We're seeing this with the 9th district. We're going to get a lot of attention. We're going to get a tremendous amount of attention during the presidential race, but also our gubernatorial race is going to draw a lot of attention nationally. And you know, Josh Stein, as you mentioned, has raised a tremendous amount of money. So I think North Carolina more and more is a larger and larger player in the national field of politics, and people want to participate in that.
A web extra follow-up that I'm going to do off the top of my head because it's not scripted in front of me, but just this conversation has made me think of a moment from the Democratic debates this week. I believe it was Steve Bullock, who is the Democratic governor from Montana, who made mention of a policy in that state where during the last 90 days, there is no dark money allowed. I know you would be in support of that, Rob. Would you be in support of that?
I'm not in support of ever limiting people's amendment, Second Amendment rights of free speech, or First Amendment rights. I'm sorry, you're going to edit this, right?
I will edit that.
Yeah,
but that's not any kind of limitation. But that's not, I mean, the ability to do something anonymously, that's not infringing on one's First Amendment right, is it?
Yeah, I think disclose, if you, and Rob has advocated for not having anonymous contributions in political races. And I think that being able to participate in the political process, exercise your freedom of speech rights, is something that has to be protected. It's protected in our Constitution. I think it follows through with these.
I think there's a strong argument to be made. There are circumstances in which anonymous speech does have First Amendment constitutional protections, but I would argue in this case there needs to be there's room for sound regulation of campaign finance contributions. And again, I think it takes us back to the place where we ought to be going, which is public campaign financing, and I think that would provide the best long-term solution to this problem.
Go ahead.
Since you brought the Democrat debate and Democrat Democratic.
That's what it's been for a couple hundred years.
Bring me up to speed here. But since you brought that into the discussion, you know, something else is the importance of raising money. One of the bars for these numerous candidates that are running for president on the Democratic side of the aisle, you know, one of the bars they have to reach is a certain fundraising level in order to qualify. So how much money you can raise, where you get it, when you get it, is critical to a lot of these campaigns. Now, whether it should be or not, I mean, we could certainly discuss that, but it's a measure that's easy.
Right.
It's a threshold and a measure that's easy
rule,
to
right.
do. And yeah, and the party set that up.
And they also distinguish between, you can't meet that threshold by simply loaning yourself $10 million. You have to have a certain number of contributions, small contributions from individuals. They're looking for an indication that the candidate is a serious candidate, someone who's actually, you know, got some sort of measure of support out there, which is something both parties have used for a long time.
Of course. But fundraising is a critical part of our political
100%.
Process. I mean, let's just, you know. Yeah.
No doubt about that.
I think some might contend that U.S. senators groveling for $1 donations might be a little bit beneath the stature of their office, but I'll move on before I get myself in trouble. I was going to save a Democratic debate reaction for the end, but we're into it now, so I'll ask you about the WRAL television investigative story here in a minute. Two nights of Democratic debates this week, a little more than 7 months now from the North Carolina primary. Listeners will remember that the state has moved up its primary, going to be a Super Tuesday primary. Which of the 20 candidates, as of today, has the best chance to take North Carolina in March?
Well, Biden's still the leader. I mean, people are taking their best shots at him. He has some real challenges in that he's not a spring chicken anymore. And there's also the issue that it's candidates for office always want to be the spokespeople for change. You want to claim the mantle of being for change. And it's a little harder for Biden. He's essentially running as a defender and a proponent of the Obama administration. And that is something that it's an easy ball to tee up for his opponents to go after, because you can find any number of things that you want to complain about. That said, he seems to have withstood some of the initial swings that have been taken at him. But gosh, it's a long way off. Who knows who will even still be running by the spring of 2020.
I realize 80 is the new 60. Joe Biden turned 77 in November. Do you have any concern about his age moving forward?
Personally, I don't. I think people can live to a ripe old age these days, just in terms of whether he's fit to serve. I mean, as long as he passes his health, I don't know what's Trump. Trump is in his 70s as well.
73, I believe.
He's
4 years younger.
I'm old enough to remember that when Ronald Reagan was elected in 1980, we were gravely concerned that he was 69. And obviously the scale has changed a lot. I think Warren's probably 70 years old or so. Sanders is older than Biden. There's several older candidates running.
Who has the best chance to win next March?
In North Carolina?
Democrat.
I agree with Rob. I think Joe Biden does. Joe Biden is in the debates that we've seen so far, he is the moderate candidate on the stage. I just cannot imagine that North Carolina is ready for some of these very progressive candidates and these ideas that we're hearing, the Medicare for all and the free this and the free that and free everything. I just cannot imagine that North Carolina historically has been a purple state. I think polling and other things would indicate that we're pretty close to the middle. And in my view, Joe Biden is the one who best reflects that on the candidates that we have right now.
A story from WRAL-TV and the Center for Investigative Reporting helped to shine a light on a child care facility in Robeson County. This facility lost a state license for its mistreatment of children with mental health challenges in 2018. However, according to the report, that organization has since been awarded a $4 million federal grant to house migrant children. It is unclear as of right now if New Horizons LLC could again house children soon. It's also unclear how much of that $4 million has been dispersed. Is there anything more that state agencies or state legislators ought to do in reaction to this story preemptively right now?
If there is, they ought to do it. I think they deserve a lot of credit. Thank goodness we've got our Department of Health and Human Services here in North Carolina actually paying attention to this kind of stuff. This hooray for government regulation that we've found that this business was unbelievable conditions that these young people were living in. And the notion that the Trump administration is going to dispense millions of dollars to them is either, I guess it's either really a terrible commentary on what their morals and values are, or it's just incompetence that they would pick such an agency to. It also, I think, raises the issue, why we privatize this stuff. You know, it raises the issue of private prisons and these private facilities that are out there to make a profit, and now we're going to trust them with children. I just think there's an inherent conflict of interest there. These ought to be public facilities, publicly run.
I think this is shocking. I think it's a shame. My full disclosure, my daughter is a recreational therapist and has worked in group homes in North Carolina, even as an intern at UNCW. And so I'm a little bit familiar with the model and how these things work. And one thing, you know, that is alarming to me is some of the stories that she's relayed and the concerns that she's had and some of the facilities that she's seen is that there is a lot of this kind of thing going on. And, you know, I think that's the alarming thing. I mean, thank goodness this has occurred. Hopefully this report will lead to an investigation. I don't know whether we need more laws about this. I'm not familiar enough to know what the laws are in place. If this is a case of the laws are in place, they're just not being fulfilled is one part of it. But, you know, I think we absolutely need to look at this, whether this is for migrant children, any place that you are placing children or people with mental health needs. It's not just children. It's our most vulnerable citizens. And we need to make sure that those facilities are getting them the treatment that they need. And if that takes more money for inspectors and, you know, to ensure that these things are being done right, in my view, that is an appropriate use of taxpayer money.
And there's nothing to stop Senator Tillis, Senator Burr, any of the North Carolina congressional delegations from speaking up and raising a little hell with the Trump administration. They ought to start right away.
Becky Gray is Senior Vice President at the John Locke Foundation. Rob Schofield is Director of NC Policy Watch. Enjoy your weekend.
Thanks,
Thank
guys.
You.